If you are looking for even more help and guidance on your breakup, I have a few different options for you to take your healing to the next level. I have 4 different online courses depending on what stage of the breakup that you're in, from beginning all the way into moving on after heartbreak. Or you can bundle all of my courses together and use the code PODCAST to get $25 off my course bundle. I also have my 30-day no contact challenge to help hold you accountable in going no contact with your ex. And we have our free Facebook group, Healing Hearts Club, where you can connect with other people going through breakups all over the world. To learn more about any of these resources, head to the show notes where you can learn more about my courses, take the quiz to figure out which course is best for you, or join the Facebook group. And don't forget to use the code PODCAST to get $25 off my course bundle. Hormones are the last thing you want to be dealing with as you're going through a breakup, but they can also be hard to ignore, especially during the time of the month. This is why I love recommending Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth, which has truly become a phenomenon trusted by over 2.2 million customers, and a bottle is sold every 24 seconds. I started taking Hormone Harmony to help balance my hormones after going through 2 pregnancies in 2.5 years, and I've continued to take it because it's made such a difference in my PMS with bloating, irritation, anxiety, and all the other not-so-fun symptoms that tend to pop up. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. It has zero sugar and is gluten-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, and third-party tested. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use code HEARTBREAK at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code HEARTBREAK for 15% off today. Welcome to the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast with your host, Breakup Bestie, aka me, Kendra. Breakups are hard, but you don't have to do it alone. Each week, I will be taking you through a different topic as it relates to breaking up, healing from heartbreak, growing in your single life, dating, and getting back into happier and healthier relationships. The goal of this show is to provide support, hope, tips, and to remind you that above all, this too shall pass. Welcome back to another episode of the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast. Today, I have Shelby Forsythia on the podcast, and we're talking all about grief. And while Shelby's focus is on grief as it relates to a death after losing her mom about 10 years ago, she really explored what is grief? What does it look like to actually grieve? But we talk about how that kind of grief is so similar to what we go through during a breakup. We talk about the 5 stages of grief and how that started and how it kind of got morphed into something that it doesn't necessarily apply to. We talk about her grief process, her 5-stage process that is so all-encompassing of things that you go through during a breakup and how to properly grieve someone and also take care of yourself during it and also reintegrate yourself back into your life without this particular person. So she is so knowledgeable on this topic, and I am very excited for you guys to listen to her and connect with her and check out her books. Welcome, Shelby, to the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast. Very excited to have you on today.
I am also really excited to be here.
So I always love, people will know, I always like to start off the interviews asking people what led them to, so where did this come from becoming a grief coach? Because like I tell people on podcasts, I didn't spend high school career day being like, I'm going to be a breakup coach. And I can't imagine you ever thought that was like an option on career day. So can you share with us how you got into this?
1000%. I think, well, high school and college career day, as it got more refined, what I was really going for initially was some flavor of writer, copywriter, book writer, novel writer, slash like a little bit of artiste in there. I remember I did a caricature of myself in 4th grade about what I want to be when I grow up. And it was literally just an artist holding a palette in a studio. So I knew I wanted to make stuff that hadn't been made yet. Essentially, it was the energy I wanted to put into the world. And then my senior year of college, my mom, she had a recurrence of cancer that came back. She was cleared almost a year earlier. And her cancer came back very suddenly. And by the time doctors kind of done doing surgeries and trying to fix the issue, they were like, there's nothing more we can do. You should call in hospice. And that was a few days before Christmas on December 19th. And the hospice nurses were like, you probably have 6 weeks to 6 months to say goodbye in the state that she's in and at the decline rate that she's facing. And she died in 7 days. And it was the most earth-shattering event I had ever faced in my life. And it came on top of 4 years of nonstop losses. I call my college years my 4 years of hell, not because I was in school, but because I was facing loss event after loss event after loss event after loss event. And it started sort of fuzzy and intangible. And then it got increasingly worse by my own personal ranking. There was financial instability. I came out of the closet as a queer person in the South in the United States. I was going through my first relationships. My father had two brain aneurysms that both needed surgery and he almost died. And then as soon as he was out of the hospital, my mom got a breast cancer diagnosis and went through treatment and surgery and chemo and radiation and all the mixed bag that goes with that. And then it went away and then she died. And I'm 10 years out now, so I'm able to talk about this like from a distance. But at the time, I often describe it as it was like the rug was pulled out from under me, but then the floor and then the foundation of the house and then the earth and then the center of the earth. And I was just falling. There was nothing underneath me. And to this day, I call it the first and the worst, the first big loss event I ever faced and the worst loss event I ever faced, because I was 21 years old. I had no tools. I had seen grief before, but from a distance, like when my grandfather died, but that was a part of the natural order of things. Like old people die, like that felt appropriate, for lack of better phrasing, and not earth-shattering in the way that my mother's death was. And that track that I was building towards being some bigwig ad man copywriter in Chicago, which is exactly what I wanted going back to my final semester in college, crashed and burned. I had no energy to do anything like that. And the thought of motivating myself to join some huge corporate machine, basically, and produce at that level and try and prove myself as a little fish in a really big pond, all of a sudden, I was so burned out by grief, I couldn't fathom doing that. And I wandered around kind of from job to job and place to place. I worked as a receptionist for a while and a florist for a little bit too. And I kept getting this urge to explore grief work, but not on other people's terms. Because after somebody dies, people push casseroles at you and books at you and support groups at you and all this other stuff. And I was like, that's not resonating. But I was reading this book, ironically called The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin. And she says, if you want to live a happier life, look to things that you used to do to feel happy as a kid. And the first memory that popped into my mind was going to the library with my mom. And so I got my first adult library card. I went to the Chicago Public Library, and the first section I was drawn to was grief. And I started reading grief books that I chose to read and posting things I was learning, quotes from authors and frameworks and just things I found interesting on my personal Facebook page. And dozens of people messaged me privately and said, this is really helping. You should do something with this. And I would tell personal stories from my own life and things like that. And gradually, probably about 3 years after my mother's death is when I actually took it public and formed a business around these thoughts I was having on grief. It started as Facebook Lives, which slowly became a podcast, which slowly became people asking to work with me one-on-one, which became a book, which then became another book, and now has grown into a community of thousands of people who have resonated with the words I use to describe grief and the frameworks that I've managed to put around the experience of grief, having worked with so many people through the years, of yes, grief is not predictable and there's a pattern to it. There are things you need in grief in order to progress through the experience of having it. And you may not do them in order and you may not do them in the same way or the same intensity as other people. But you're absolutely right. I did not set out to become a grief coach. I did not think that was going to be a quote unquote gift of my grief. A lot of people say, oh, grief has its gifts, blah, blah, blah. And I don't love when people use that language. But if I can assign this one to myself, it really has been the gift of grief to turn these gifts of creativity and writing into something that at first helped me and then resonated with so many other people.
That's amazing. And I want to earmark the gifts of grief topic, because I think it's an important one. And I think it's important how it's framed, but we can get into that kind of later on. But so there may be a lot of people listening to this who have experienced a death and maybe to the same magnitude and suddenness of your mother's death. But a lot of people here are, just experiencing a relational breakup. And do you feel like over the course of the time that you have been in this space? Do you feel, because I feel like at one point it was like grief was only the loss of a parent, a spouse, a child, you know, a child. It was very specific and it wasn't necessarily quote unquote valid for other people to feel like they're experiencing grief. Do you feel like that scope has widened? In what ways do you feel like that's happened?
I think it depends on what corners of society you live in.
Okay.
Socially, culturally, economically, even your job, the people you surround yourself with, familially, because some corners and pockets of society, especially with the COVID pandemic, which physically separated so many of us, people are acknowledging a lot of non-death events as grief now in ways that they used to not. And there is still some really ingrained, awful, like, ranking system that exists of like a death is the very worst, and then a divorce, and then a breakup, and then losing your house, and then losing your job. And there's a very structured ranking in the eyes of some people that says this counts as a grief event and this does not, or this counts as the worst grief event and everything else is not as bad. And something I often say around breakups, and this is an early piece that I wrote in 2019 or 2017, after the person I was engaged to at the time broke up with me very unexpectedly, and it turned into a very cruel and angry experience on their part, was that in grief, there is loss due to death. For death-related losses, there's loss due to death and grief due to death, and you mourn the past that can only be remembered by the two of you. You mourn the present and having to survive this by yourself, and you mourn the future that you were supposed to have. With breakup-related losses, whether divorce or breakup of an engagement, you mourn the past that only the two of you remember. You mourn the present for having to go it alone. But with regard to the future, you're not just grieving the future that was supposed to happen. You also have to watch them live out a separate one. And you have to live out a separate one. And you're actually alive while it's happening. And so there's a different, and pardon the language, but there's a different sense of like twisting a knife in the wound, because it's not that the person's dead and gone and that's all there is of the relationship, although that's a difficult enough thing to grieve. It's that they are gone and you both must continue to be alive and negotiate the emotions related to that breakup for the rest of your lives. I'm a big block them and don't talk to them anymore sort of person, so I don't have to see that a lot of the time. But for people that I have broken up with on relatively good terms, or at some point we reconciled and acknowledged, like, that was hard, but I'm glad you were part of my life, there's still, I don't know, 1-10% twinge of pain when I go on their social media, when I see them in real life, of like, wow, we were supposed to have been XYZ, and now I'm watching you live a totally different future with this person, or in this part of the country, or doing this job, or doing, there are parts of you that I'm seeing for the first time as somebody who is not your partner. And I grieve even now, even joyfully married myself. And sometimes my other partners have been joyfully married, people I've broken up with or have broken up with me, and watching them live parallel lives that aren't with me. There is still a twinge of very active grief. And I think negotiating breakups is learning to carry that. So yeah, again, I think it depends on what corners of society you're inhabiting as opposed to how the mental rankings work. But in my work, I always say only you can rank your own griefs, which is why I call my mother's death the first and the worst. The death of my best friend is second for me. And then the breakup of my engagement is very much third. Even though I've lost other people to death, people I'm related to, I do not rank them as high as like those top three grief events in my life.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very beautifully worded way to talk about the feeling of a breakup in that way. And I feel I was like laughing because me too, happily married, long time. I recently, an ex of mine got married and I broke up with them, but it still was just like this. It's like this weird parallel live thing where you're like, oh, at one point I pictured all this happening with you, and it's very strange. And I think a lot of it comes down to trusting yourself and trusting your own feelings around things. Cause I know there's, you know, if something happens and people might see it as a big deal, but for you, it's just not registering as a big deal and feeling like, oh, should I be more upset about this? Should I feel this way? And then there's ones where it feels like, oh, maybe it shouldn't be as big of a deal, but it's a really, really big deal to me. A lot of it has to do with, you know, validating your own feelings, I imagine.
1000%. That's part of why I called my first book Permission to Grieve, because one of the biggest things that we struggle with, and I'm also writing about this in a different way again in my third book, is do we have a right to our emotions? It's almost like we have to stand on trial in front of some imaginary court of like, yes, I have a right to feel betrayed, even though it's been 8 years, or yes, I have a right to feel ripped off or sorrowful or nostalgic or whatever. And it's like, I'm presenting case A, B, C, and D. It's exhibit all these things. And then it's like there's some, again, like some societal marker or some judgment that's going to come down, a gavel bangs, and you're like, yes, you're allowed to feel that emotion, or no, you're not allowed to feel that emotion. And I very much have that experience of like fighting with myself, my own judgy voice in my head. And so much of the grief work that I've even done for myself, not to mention with clients, is just, yes, you're right, validating that you can feel that emotion. I don't know that any experience in grief is crazy or unwarranted. Everybody I've ever worked with, whether we're going from rage to numbness, is normal for the experience that they're having. I have a very dear friend. She's a death doula named Alua Arthur. She just put a gorgeous book out this year called Briefly Perfectly Human, about how thinking about death makes us better people in life. And she sits by the bedsides of people who are dying and watches all the family dynamics unfold as they're watching a loved one die. And she's seeing lots of expressions of grief. And she's like, not one of them is abnormal. They all belong. Joy, rage, fear, sorrow. Absolutely checking out and taking a million phone calls, answering emails as the person next to you is dying. All normal for whatever your life circumstances are. Yeah. And so you can be quote unquote irrationally upset, you know, 12 years later that your ex is getting married. You can judge them for doing farmhouse chic, absolutely, and have kind of that joy of the misery of other people's lives if you consider that to be miserable. But there can also be a sense of, oh, some piece of that, some ritual of that, some emotional element of that was supposed to be mine, and having to release that over and over again. It's a grief practice. Grief is very much a practice, not like a one-time thing.
I love that analogy of the presenting of feelings in court. It's so wild how we do that. It's so wild. And if we think about too, all the time and energy we spend on rationalizing our feelings instead of just feeling them and processing them and all of that. Instead, we're like, okay, I feel mad. Should I feel mad? I shouldn't feel mad. This isn't really that big of a deal, but I'm feeling this and they did this and then they did this, instead of like, oh, I'm mad. Okay, I'm mad. Like, that's okay. That's valid. But I always say that too about with breakups. I've never had someone come to me and say, I'm feeling this way about the breakup. And I'm like, whoa, that's weird. Like, that's so abnormal. Yeah. You know, that's like never been something that I have come across in all the people I've talked to with breakups. It's everything's normal.
Yeah, it's just a different flavor and story per person. Yeah, I get totally different iterations of grief depending on who I'm talking to and what their relationship is to the person or the thing that they're grieving and how long it's been and where in the world they are and if they've experienced grief before. Like, it's very much, grief always is like a situation of permutations and combinations, and it shows up differently each time. The grief I felt for my mother, wildly different flavor than the grief I felt when my engagement broke up, wildly different than the grief I felt when my best friend died. And so the three of those, you could put them under the giant Rihanna umbrella of grief, but then in each of them, it's like they almost have these Venn diagrams of overlapping emotions and experiences, but they're always moving and shifting and changing. It's very blobby.
Yeah.
It's very blobby in there. That's a wonderful takeaway for people who are listening right now. Instead of having to feel like you take your emotions to court, simply naming them, I am mad, or asking yourself, like, what if this was just allowed? What if whatever this feeling was okay? And I think a lot of us fight to prove that we're allowed to have our emotions, because once we do name them and allow them, it's like, well, now what? What do I do with it? Now that I know that I'm mad, what do I do with that information? What do I do with that experience of emotion? And it's a lot easier, heavy air quotes on easier, to fight with ourselves about a right to have an emotion than to actually feel it. It takes it from the logical to the felt experience, from the head to the heart. And then you're like, well, crap, if I actually am mad and I'm going to feel mad, then where does it go? What do I do with that? And that's a lot of the work that I do, is taking grief from the head and actually moving it through your words, through your body, through creative expression, or however it unfolds for you. It's like, how do you actually move through the emotional experience of grieving?
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know that when I'm navigating a tough chapter in life, my self-care practices tend to go out the window. And unfortunately, I've learned the hard way that a hard time is exactly when I need to make sure I'm sticking to my self-care non-negotiables. Whether it's journaling, reaching out to friends, moving your body, or attending therapy, you deserve to take time for yourself, even when it feels like everything around you is a struggle. I love that therapy allows me to set aside time for me and forces me to focus on what I'm going through and myself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartbreak today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/heartbreak. Did you know that 9 out of 10 women lack dominance of L. crispatus, which is why many endure ongoing vaginal discomfort? That's why one of my absolute favorite supplement companies, Seed, created VS01 Vaginal Symbiotic to restore a healthy vaginal microbiome and sustain regulated pH levels. After using VS01 for just a couple months, I've noticed a difference. Other products out there often target only symptoms in ways that further disturb the microbiome, which is so important, just like your gut microbiome. VS01 marks a new era in vaginal care with a sustainable approach to address the root cause of imbalances. This is an ongoing system that maximizes efficacy with minimal impact on your day-to-day life. Shift from harsh reactive treatments to proactive sustainable care with VS01 from Seed. Go to seed.com/heartbreak and use code 25heartbreak to get 25% off. That's 25% off VS01 at seed.com/heartbreak, code 25heartbreak. You know, after going through a breakup, your photos need to be replaced and memory lane can feel like a scary place to walk down. But don't forget that you still have so many people in your life who love you and so many memories that don't involve your ex. And Artifact Uprising is here to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. I have been an Artifact Uprising customer for years now, and I love that they have such high quality prints and beautiful books that are great for putting up in my home or giving as gifts. Just recently, I made a photo book with photos of my 3 boys from this year. But what I also made, which I highly recommend all of you do, is I made a book with photos of just my best girlfriends, which I now have on my coffee table. It's such a great way for me to see all of my favorite memories with the women in my life who are my rocks. So whether you want to put up some new photos with friends and family around your house, or you want to put together a book as a thank you for the people who are holding you up during this tough time, Artifact Uprising is the place to do it. Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Heal Your Heartbreak listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use code heartbreak through December 31st.
So true. It's, I mean, not to simplify it in the way, but like it can be like a distraction from actual feelings. Sure. Of I'd rather work through my thoughts about my feelings instead of my feelings. And I know you have your grief method, and I think it's been really interesting. I just listened to a podcast on grief last week, and they were talking about just how the 5 stages of grief got so ingrained as like, this is the 5 stages of grief. Isn't it not really even about a death? It like came from some other framework and just really stuck as this thing of like, this is how we deal with grief.
Yeah. You know, that thing where the media takes an idea and they're like, we can slap this on something else and call it the same thing is exactly what happened. And I'm laughing, but it actually, I think, has wounded our society in some pretty big ways, because Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages was originally designed to describe the experience of people who were given a terminal diagnosis and they were dying. And okay. So when a doctor comes in the room and says to you, you have 9 weeks to live. The process generally that she observed that they went through, in no particular order, she called it the 5 stages, but she's like, they're not always in order, even when she wrote it in the 1970s, 80s, is denial of, this isn't happening to me, this isn't my life, the diagnosis isn't real, there's got to be another way. Anger, oh my God, it is true, I got to rage this out somewhere, why me, why God, why this? Bargaining, denial, anger, bargaining. Yep. Is maybe I can fix this. Maybe I can do another trial medication. Maybe I can, you know, reckon with God and get a miracle. Depression. Oh, this is really true. This is really happening. There's no way out. Hopelessness, powerlessness, helplessness. And then finally acceptance. they arrive at some place where it's like, this is reality. This is the rest of my days on Earth. Then what do I do with that information? And what happened is the media, upon her publishing her findings through books and through scientific studies and papers and working in so many hospices and hospitals around the world, people were like, oh, this could apply to their families too. Of like, the families will go through denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And that's not what happened, because that's not how grief works. So after somebody you love dies, you don't go through those things in that order. You go through all of those things in a crazy order and then more.
Yeah.
It's like every letter of the alphabet times 40 with all of the different emotional experiences you have. And I love that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross actually wrote a follow-up book with David Kessler, who's one of the foremost experts on grief. And it's called On Grief and Grieving. And she breaks down here's why the five stages of grief was never meant for grief. And here's how it actually works, with a bunch of different examples about how the five stages can show up in grief, but then the expansion beyond that, because there is so much more to the grief experience. So when I tell people I have a five-step method for going through grief, they're like, it's not the five stages, is it? I'm like, oh God, no. I just invented a five-step method after working with people for many, many years. And I just so happened to be able to call it the grief method, G-R-I-E-F.
And it just so happens to be five steps as well.
And it just so happens to be five. I also know from a psychological perspective, and this is tangential, but like, people's brains have a hard time holding more than five things at once. It's like if I were to hand you like five oranges or something, when it starts to get to six, we start to drop some stuff.
Yeah.
And people's brains, especially when they're grieving, are the same way. It's like, I can hold one task, I can hold two tasks, I can hold three, but you start getting to four and five and we're getting a little dicey. More than that, it's, I can't hold anymore in this experience that I'm having. So when you're in states of shock or overwhelm or numbness, especially after a loss, it's like more than five of anything is overwhelming. I also think that's why listicles and things are so popular, of like, five things I learned from my breakup, or five things you should never say to your ex, or five things you should never post on social media after a breakup.
Yes.
Like, I really think that's why things like that are so popular. And I'm totally going to click on that one more than I would 22 things to never say to your mother-in-law. Like, that's way too many.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's true, but that's way too many for my brain to hold. So yeah, five just seems to be a really perfect number when you're grieving.
Can you give us, I guess, as brief as you feel like would still be appropriate to explain it, of the grief method?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is a method that I teach inside of my online course, which is called Life After Loss Academy. It's been around since 2020. So we're going on year four now of people moving and going through it. And it's not designed to take you from the early days of grief to later days of grief. One of the biggest questions I get is it time sensitive? Like, do I have to be within the first year of a loss in order for this to apply? And my answer is always no, you can do it at any time. What it's designed to do is take you from a place of feeling the world is unsafe, the best part of my life is over, there's no way out of this, and I have no idea how I'm going to live the rest of my life with grief, to I can live a good life with grief. I can define that on my own terms. I can remember my people. I can feel safe in a world that has taught me anything can happen at any time to anyone. And I know what to do with the painful and difficult emotions of grief. So it essentially takes people who are grieving from a place of I am unequipped to handle loss to I am very equipped to handle loss, both in the very acute, I just need to be able to find 10 minutes of peace in my day, which we do at the very beginning, all the way to I know exactly how to build a life that honors me as a grieving person. So G-R-I-E-F, ground, release, integrate, establish, and foster. And I'll kind of show you what each of those means. The ground module is the first one for a reason, because when you are deep in grief, no matter how long it's been, again, the world has taught you that anything can happen to anyone at any time. And to feel safe or to feel peace or to feel calm in a world where that is true is one of the biggest tasks of your life as a grieving person. And so through mindfulness tools and journaling exercises and the five senses, having our body help us ground is everything that entire module is devoted to, is how do I feel safe in a world where loss has taught me anything can happen? Once you've sort of built that foundation for yourself, because now you have a safe place to come back to, no matter what other work you do in this course, if you get an emotional hangover, you go back to square one, and there's nothing wrong with it. There's so many people that return to that over and over again. Once we build that foundation of grounding, then I'll show you how to release. And this is what a lot of people think of when they think of doing grief work, especially with a therapist. They think of, here's where I put the emotions of grief. Here's how I take the, I'm fighting to prove my emotions in the courtroom in my head, to actually expressing them and moving through them or moving beyond them so you can do other stuff. And I tell people, you don't just release once and then you're done.
That would be
you
so
build
nice.
A practice of releasing for the rest of your life. And one of the first things I have people do is tell themselves or remind themselves, what do I know for sure? This is inspired by Oprah, who has a column with that name in her magazines. But there's this myth, I think, that loss takes away everything. Everything is different. Nothing is the same. I have changed entirely. When in reality, 99% of everything is different, or some things have changed, or I've lost most of what I used to know. But for grieving people to say, I still drive the same truck, I still have the same job, I still have green eyes, I still have blonde hair, I still hate olives. That's my consistent one, is like, I hated olives before my mother died, I hate olives after my mother died. Loss couldn't take that away from me. And so to have that as your foundation of like, I don't have to release those things, is amazing. So then we talk about the things you do have to release. I have to release the notion of a future together. I have to release the sense of them sleeping in bed next to me for a spouse or a dog. You know, who are you grieving? Where that is true, I have to release the idea of myself as a morning person. I shifted my sleeping patterns after my mother's death. So I'm grieving myself in ways. This is where we grieve the person we used to be and the life we used to live, and also grieve the things related to the loss. It's grieving literally everything. And we do this in a very organized sort of checklist way. So the brain has something to hold on to in terms of a framework for releasing. Because if you say, release the emotions of your loss, people are like, how do I do that? Yeah. This is the how. And then for each thing on that list, we come up with some sort of ritual or some sort of motion to move that through your body. So I had a client once whose daughter died by suicide. She was in the LGBTQ community and faced a lot of bullying, even as an adult, and chose to sadly take her life. And her releasing ritual for her daughter's future, never getting to see a wedding, never getting to see her in a happy partnership, so many things, was going to the river beside her home. And for each of the things she was releasing, to release a leaf into the river and to watch it until she couldn't see it anymore. And to take those things that live in her brain and live in her heart and have a physical ritual outside of her body changed the course of her grief. She's like, I finally had something to do with those emotions. I've had people rearrange their closets after, especially after a spouse or a child dies. I've had people transition like their work environments, especially work from home environments when a spouse is gone, especially for breakups and divorces. I've had a lot of people like reorganize cupboards. Like there's a lot of home reorganization sometimes that happens after loss, not necessarily getting rid of things, but it's like, I finally put my mugs where I can reach them. God damn it. Some of it's really funny. And a lot of it though is just cathartic. I've had people dance. I've had people draw. I've had people paint. I've had people do so many things. I've had people take up kickboxing as a ritual. It's like, I'm going to get over
that. I always recommend kickboxing for breakups. Because it's movement. It's like, how do we not get it so stagnant of, I don't know. I feel like we get so antsy with feelings of like, I just want to like get, I don't know. So being able to do something tangible, like releasing the leaves or something feels productive.
Yes. Well, and I like that you said antsy, because our brains and our nervous systems need the grief to go somewhere. And Amelia and Emily Nagoski write in their book, Burnout, the stress cycle, is to complete a stress cycle of being activated and being so coursing with adrenaline and so stressed out. And grief is a stress event. To complete the stress cycle, you do some sort of activity that shows your body you are releasing big energy, and then you're coming back to a baseline. And that tells your nervous system, is like, wow, you just did a thing related to this really hard and difficult energy. And now we can return to some sort of baseline again, whether it's as gentle as releasing leaves into the river, or like breaking a 2x4 in a kickboxing class, or whatever you break in kickboxing class. I don't know. I know it's violent, but whatever it is, it shows your brain that this stress event can be limited to this activity, and then you can move on to processing and releasing other things. Then you do other activities, and you go clean out your closet, then you arrange the cupboards. Like there's so many different things you can do to move through the experience of grief. And so that's, a lot of people call it the hardest part of Life After Loss Academy, because it's actually looking at what you lost and taking an inventory of it. But after you move through it, the people coming into the next module are like, wow, I feel so much lighter. I feel so much more clear. I feel so much less burdened, which is a lot of what they come in feeling. So I'll rush through the next three. The next one is the integrate module. And this is really fun for a lot of people, because this is how we honor either the people who have died or the relationships that we have lost. And so doing things like looking for signs and symbols from them, messages from the universe, if you believe in something like that, but then also identity-wise, seeing yourself as a grieving person. So moving through the world, looking at jobs, like as a grieving person, what sort of employment should I look for? As a grieving person, what do I need, you know, from the apartment or the living space that I'm in? As a grieving person, or you could say in your case, like as a person who's recently been broken up with, how do I want to take public transit? Do I want to be on my phone all the time, or do I want to be looking up and around at other people? Mm. Like, how do I want to approach the world as a person who's just experienced a breakup? And you get to decide how that happens. And so kind of folding your identity in and integrating grief into your larger life, because it exists there already, but actually naming it is really fun for a lot of people. And even for breakups, a lot of people are like, well, nobody died. I can't like look for a bird and think of them, because that happens, you know, a lot of times for people in death. I look for birds a lot as a sign from my mom. But I tell people, especially with divorces and breakups, to like look for a word that's inspiring to you, or maybe a color or something like that. I coached a woman once who was going through a divorce, and she chose glitter. She's like, anything with glitter, because I love things that sparkle. And the person I was dating did not appreciate my sparkly clothes. And so seeing anybody out on the town with some glittery boots or a glittery hat or a glittery purse, she's like, that's going to remind me to be myself in the next relationship that I choose. And that became a way she folded in the grief of the breakup, but then also anticipating and looking for what was next. The fourth step in the grief method is establish. And this is where we talk about how we do grief with other people. And this is like fan favorite across the board. All my students love this one, because the first three modules are how do you survive personally, yeah, this grief experience? The fourth module is how do you do grief with other people? And so I'll show you how to take an inventory of your friends, family, coworkers, the people you're regularly surrounded by, and say, these people are my grief allies. They sit on the couch, they listen to me talk, they bring casseroles, they mow the lawn, they walk the dog, whatever it is that helps you feel loved in grief. These people, I feel like 50-50, sometimes I can bring my grief to them and sometimes I can't. And then people who are, you do not feel safe with your grief at all. And then learn how to, through scripts, through boundary setting tools, through naming the ways in which they hurt you, slowly start to reshape your relationships. So for instance, I have a list of the 11 toxic grief tropes. And one of the most common ones is the rose-colored reframer. People are always like, look on the bright side, you totally dodged a bullet. There's a silver lining to everything. And to approach somebody who's a rose-colored reframer and say, hey, so when we were at the park last week and you told me that after breaking up with this person, I really dodged a bullet, I know you're right, but it really hurt my feelings in the moment because it felt like you were trying to gloss over the hurt that I'm still feeling. So in the future, it would be really helpful if we could, you know, have a greater focus on what I'm feeling in the moment, or talk about what I miss from the relationship, or talk about if I'm ready to do this, the people that I'm looking for on the dating app, or whatever it is, like redirecting that energy of trying to reframe something into something that actually benefits both of you in your relationship, and then coming up with a plan based on how they respond. So what are you going to do if this friend responds well? What are you going to do if they respond poorly? And what are you going to do if they don't respond at all? And so it's these really lovely and wonderful ways of making all of the relationships in your life feel grief honoring, both for breakups, but then also if death happens in your future, or if other loss events, major diagnosis, geographic move, COVID, God forbid,
we global, have global pandemic.
Like, then God knows we are so much more able to hold space for each other when we're not trying to rose color reframer each other all the time. And there's 11 tropes like that. So there's the social media sympathizer that only sympathizes with your pain on social media, but never reaches out privately. There's the audacious assumer who always thinks they know what you need, but they don't actually know what you need and they don't ask. There's the judgmental judger who's like, you're still not over them yet. What's wrong with you? And so all these different categories of toxic people you can have in your life in grief, and boundary setting statements of like, how do you shift your life so that they hear that you need something to change because now you are a grieving person and that's not a bad thing. And then what to do if they respond well or poorly or not at all. And then finally, how to look for new friends if you seem to be pruning a lot of them that do honor or are capable of honoring your grief. So like people in the Heal Your Heartbreak community, it's like, how do you find more people like that in the world? And then lastly, foster. This is where we talk about how do you build a good lifetime partnership with grief? And good is very subjective. It's what it means to you. So this is not my definition of good. It's your definition of good. And this is all about seeing grief, fittingly for this podcast, as a long-term relationship. There's the getting to know you stage where everything feels really intense and sometimes really uncomfortable and really crazy, very, very short term. There's the longer sort of, I'm getting used to grief. I'm starting to see the patterns in it. I've lived through a bunch of grief anniversaries, could be death anniversaries, could be birthdays, could be we were supposed to get married on this day and then we broke up, whatever they mean to you, surviving a few of those and seeing I can actually get through this. And then across the very long arc of your life, how do you make room and space for your grief? And how do you grow and mature together through the rest of your lifetime? So I teach my students to see grief as a living thing, whether a human entity or an animal that you're taking care of for the rest of your life, that will have different needs and different wants and different expressions of joy and of pain for the rest of its life. So in the early days of my grief, I was journaling about it. I was doing meditations. I was singing. I was dancing. I was cooking. I was doing all these things to cope with grief. And now 10 years after the death of my mother, grief's a little more in the background. Still tied to me, because we are always tied to the grief that we face. But now I honor my mother on big grief anniversaries. When I see mothers and daughters together in public, especially on Mother's Day, I have like little rituals that I do to cope with that, but it's not as loud. And then sometimes it roars in really big and loud, like on the day of her 10th death anniversary. I'm like, we are now in double digits. And that is a whole new experience. So it's like as fresh as it was on day one, but now with all of the maturity and all the tools, I have to cope with it now. And so growing with grief across a lifetime, like you would a partner, whether it's an unpleasant roommate you never asked to move in, or somebody you can actually see as a collaborator and a teacher and a mentor through life's hardships, how do you move with grief for the rest of your life? How do you find meaning? How do you cooperate with each other? How do you listen to each other? And teaching mindfulness tools, journaling tools, and just language tools to creatively see grief as a companion that's not here to harm you, but is here to be a force for your good life for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Man, that's so, as someone who's not necessarily experiencing an active loss for me, it just feels like such a thorough grounding process to be able to work through regardless of what the loss looks like. And it's so funny, like all the questions I had for you were brought up through this process. Like it is such a thorough thing. It's amazing.
It is. I did that on purpose. This is everything I know about grief in one place.
Yeah.
And that's not an understatement at all.
I want to kind of touch on a few things that you said, but the fostering part I think is so important because it's, I just know so many people and I get so many messages from people who feel like, I don't know what, I think sometimes people think there's some big finish line with a breakup where you break through the tape and you're like, I did it. I'm done. Like, I'm good. But it's, in my experience, it's just so much more subtle than that. It's where you look up and you're like, oh, I haven't cried in like a couple weeks, or, oh, I, you know, I don't know. It looks so different for everyone. And so being able to define what does it mean to live in harmony with this experience, and what does it look like for me to be quote unquote over it, even though I don't like that terminology, but you know, I think it's really important to personally set what does it mean for you to move through this is so important, because people do still think, and again, I'm speaking more specifically to breakups, but people do think, oh, I want to just wipe away the memory. I don't want to think about them anymore. And it's like, that's not going to happen. Like, I think about my boyfriend I had when I was 12, you know, it's like, we just don't wipe things away like that. So I love the way of, you know, being able to live with it in harmony. And what you were saying too about learning how to do it with other people, because that was a big question that I had too, is this, and it's been interesting because this has come up the last couple of days for me, just in conversations with friends, of this whole rose-colored glasses, setting boundaries around that, and, you know, seeing, I don't know, the way my mom would describe it is blessing in disguise and all of that. And I've really changed how I view that as I get older, because I do believe in my gut that that does happen, but I know how harmful it is in the moment to hear stuff like that. I was talking to, I had my twins in January. They were born early. They were in the NICU. It was very stressful. And I remember people saying, oh man, but it'll be so nice. You'll be all recovered from your C-section by the time they get home, and telling me stuff like that, which now I look back and yes, that was beneficial that I did that. But at the time it felt so so painful, so invalidating. And so being able to differentiate between, especially someone like me who's been raised with, I probably more on the toxic positivity side where you're supposed to find the silver lining, being able to navigate that line of, I'm going to honor what I'm feeling right now, but also, I guess, know deep down that something good will come out of it? Like, what are your thoughts on navigating that line? And I'm probably asking this from a personal standpoint too.
I love that. No. I think part of why we become podcasters is to selfishly ask personal questions.
100%, 1000%. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Well, that's for sure. Part of why I started my first podcast in 2017 is so I could ask people who I perceive to be experts in their field things about my own personal grief.
Yeah,
for sure. I'm calling myself out as I'm calling you out. I totally hear you. And I think there can be a great towing of a line, and it's really hard to know where it is, especially in the moment. But I always prefer to err on the side of validate the feelings of the person in grief first before assigning a meaning, because you dodged a bullet, you're going to be all healed from this by the time they get out of the hospital. Maybe intellectually true, could be totally true. And emotionally, it's like, that is the last thing I needed to hear right now, is that a person I mindfully chose to be potentially married to in the future, or that these babies who cannot escape a NICU ward and that my healing body are going to be healing at the same time. Like, sure, helpful, emotionally, last thing I need to hear right now. It's kind of like, I don't know if this resonates with you as a metaphor, but like some people really, really love like ice water with like a lot of ice in it, like that cool, super refreshing water. But then you don't want that dumped on your head, or you don't want to be forced to drink ice water. I have really sensitive teeth, so I hate anything with ice in it. It's like, you don't want to be forced to drink the same thing somebody else is drinking. What is cooling and refreshing for one is going to be really painful or really disruptive to another, whether you're forcing them to drink it or dumping it on their head. And a lot of times the silver lining or the assigning meaning of a loss event, no matter if it's a preemie delivery or a breakup, feels a lot like somebody foisting something upon you that you didn't ask for. So the two big phrases that I teach supporters to use when they're companioning grieving people, and this is actually what I'm writing my third book about, is what to say to grieving people, because I think it is as simple as language. You don't always have to bring a casserole or mow their lawn or walk their dog or watch their kids or sit on the couch and bring them coffee, especially from a distance, because COVID changed how we support each other in grief big time, separated by time zones and countries sometimes even. Is phrase number one, this is really hard. Just validating that this is a really hard, or this is really scary, or this is really uncertain, or this is really tricky or uncomfortable or sticky or unexpected, especially for a sudden loss or a breakup. You can say, wow, this is really unexpected. Or if you're really open to swearing, which a lot of people are in this day and age when it comes to grief, it's like, this really sucks. This is fucking stupid. Like, this is frustrating on like a cellular level. And to say nothing more than that, because you don't have to fix the fact that it's frustrating. You just have to look at it, point at it, and say, this is so frustrating. The second thing that I advise people to say is, I see how hard you're trying. Because sometimes what people need to hear in the midst of the awful thing, especially when loss, breakup, death, diagnosis blows your life apart, is that I can see that you're trying really hard, insert thing here, to hold it all together, to be there for your family, to perform at work. Like, what is it that you're trying really hard to plan a beautiful memorial, to heal for your baby so you can take care of them? But if somebody had walked into your hospital room and said, this is really hard, or this is really difficult, or this was really unexpected, holy crap, and I see how hard you're trying just to make it through the dang day. Like, that changes your entire experience of conversation with that person. And you no longer feel like, wow, you're just painting me with meaning. You're painting my whole story before I've even made sense of it, versus like, wow, you're sitting right here with me right now as a witness to what's happening. And so many grieving people, breakup, death, divorce, diagnosis, whatever the case may be, just need a witness to what they're experiencing. Because even when we're surrounded by people, it's incredibly lonely inside our heads.
Well, and if we go back to what we were saying at the beginning, if we can remember that most of us are operating from, I'm just going to keep coming back to that courtroom analogy, or so many of us are in our courtroom trying to, you know, rationalize our feelings, mm-hmm. knowing that you can come in and validate it for someone. I mean, you can think of the relief that it can provide that person. So I love that you're writing a book on that. I think that's so necessary. And I think a lot of people don't say the right thing because they just don't know what. And I tell people that with breakups, I'm like, most people aren't saying things to be mean or to hurt you. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to help you. They're going to help you in the way that they think they would like help. But a lot of people don't even know how they want help. So they're operating from a good spot. But that doesn't mean you can't give them what you said, like feedback and boundaries and how they can, you know, better help you. So yeah. I love this. This work you're doing is so important and so valuable. And I really hope people, even the people that are going through breakup where there's no death involved, being able to go through the life after loss program, because I think it's very, very valuable. And can you share with people how they can join the program and find you and connect with you?
Totally. Yes. I make it super simple because Grief Brain is real. It's just shelbyforsythia.com. And it's very easy to find Life After Loss Academy. It's up in the programs bar at the top. If you want to take a free workshop that's like a sneak peek of Life After Loss Academy before buying all the way in, you can certainly do that. That's at the top of the website as well. And I have had people take this course who are grieving themselves. But like you said, I've also had friends and family of grieving people take it too and say, oh my God, I needed this for my neighbor, for my daughter, for my whoever that's grieving in their lives. Because even though these tools aren't necessarily applicable to me, we can start to do them together. I can change my language and how I witness their pain. And suddenly the shape of their grief and the shape of our relationship has changed for the better. Or if people come in grieving something they perceive to be small, like a breakup, because they're like, well, it's not a death. It shouldn't be that big of a deal. And then they come in saying, wow, I do need to feel safe in the world again after this happened, especially in cases of abuse or narcissism or dysfunction in a relationship. I have so much to release about past, present, and future. I have so many things I need to reintegrate. So as a person who has dated a narcissist before, for instance, what do I need from a place of employment? I need a boss who doesn't have those same traits. These questions are still worth asking. In establishing your relationships with other people, you want to surround yourself with people who validate that that happened. They do not gaslight you saying, well, it wasn't that bad, or so glad you're rid of him, blah, blah, blah. You want people who validate it was as bad as you thought, and I'm so glad you're out. And when you foster a lifetime partnership with yourself as a person who's gone through a devastating breakup, you ask your grief over that breakup of like, what do you need right now? It may be a year of no dating. It may be a retreat with other people who are healing from narcissistic relationships. It may be more of this podcast. Like, how do you foster a good life with that being true in your life, regardless of the type of grief that it is? So I've definitely had people take the course for themselves, but then also for people that they're supporting. And I think this is really cheesy and maybe it's tacky, but I really think it's universally helpful because at some point we will all grieve. And whether you're in it right now or you're going to be in it eventually, the tools are super helpful.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. So thank you so much, Shelby. I'm going to link your website in the show notes so people can find it easily. But thank you so much for coming on again and sharing your experience and your wisdom and your knowledge and all of that. We really appreciate it.
I'm really glad to have been here. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. If you loved it, I hope you'll leave a review and share with your friends. If you're not already following me on Instagram, head to @yourbreakupbestie, where I'm sharing new content almost every day. To join our Facebook group, Healing Hearts Club, where you can connect with thousands of people from all over the world going through breakups, head to the link in the show notes. And don't forget to check out my online courses for more in-depth help through your healing journey. I always end these episodes the same way, reminding you to be nice to yourself, stay connected with loved ones, and the biggest reminder is that this too shall pass. I promise.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.